Today is the first day of our September-October 7-day session at Chapin Mill. It's the 29th of September 2018. And for the first two or three days, we're going to be reading from a book called Attaining the Way, A Guide to the Practice of Chan Buddhism. And this book is has the teachings of several different Chinese masters in it, mainly late Chan Master Xing Yin. And we're going to start reading from the translator's preface. The translator is Guo Gu, that's his Dharma name. His regular name is Jimmy Yu, and he's a disciple of Master Xing Yin, and now a teacher in his own right. And he starts off by explaining some of the terminology that's used in the text. He says, "The primary methods of meditation mentioned in this volume are Gungan, literally public case, Japanese koan, Huado, Japanese wato, and Mojao, Japanese mokusho. This last method is translated here as silent illumination, and it is the origin of the Japanese Zen method of shikantaza, or just sitting. This method is often misunderstood by practitioners of the past and present as a form of quietism. But since Master Xing Yin clears up this misunderstanding in this volume, I will not expand on it here. But we'll go to at least one passage of Master Xing Yin's here, because it's good at the beginning of Sesshin to review the different practices that people are doing. And there are a number of people in the Sesshin who are doing shikantaza. So just a little bit about this from Master Xing Yin. And this is under a heading, Silent Illumination. He says, "The method of silent illumination is also known in Zen as shikantaza, from the Chinese zhiguan dazuo. In the West, this has also become known as just sitting. If this method is used incorrectly, you may as well make tea by soaking stones in cold water. Misusing it can also amount to escaping into the demon cave to weave dreams of unconcern." That is, unconcern about awakening. You could say also about the question of suffering, being unconcerned about resolving this matter. "The practitioner who does not understand this method can become like an old turtle buried in an ancient well for centuries. Suddenly one day it is dug up and comes back to life. But this turtle is still a turtle. It hasn't changed into a phoenix. One surmises that all of this time the old turtle was not really cultivating practice, because just sitting is not the same as having nothing to do. To avoid the fate of the turtle, it is important to understand the proper use of this method. In silent illumination, your mind focuses on the awareness of your body sitting in meditation and nothing else. Therefore, correct posture is critical. Do not focus on parts of the body, but be aware of the totality of the body as a unity." And this is very helpful instruction. So otherwise, shikantaza can at times feel quite amorphous. But work towards an awareness of the totality of the body as a unity. Actually, to do this, it effectively, it's very hard to have much else going on in the mind to hold that awareness. Your body parts may have different feelings and sensations, but be aware only of the whole body. Your awareness of you just sitting there should fill your mind. If your awareness falters, check and correct your posture, then resume being aware of your sitting and its sensation as a total unity. When he says when your awareness falters, check and correct your posture, particularly to check the spine, that it is energized, the sense of connecting with the cushion, rooted on your mat, and then also stretching up towards the ceiling, the sky. I think it's Master Dogen who uses the image of sitting like a mountain, very stable, very earthed, and at the same time with its head in the clouds. Tall, sitting tall is a way of thinking about it. While you are practicing just sitting, be clear about everything going on in your mind. Whatever you feel, be aware of it, but never abandon the awareness of your whole body sitting there. Again, very useful instruction. We're aware of thoughts coming and going, feelings coming and going, but in the context of the whole body sitting on the mat, sitting on the cushion. Shikantaza is not sitting with nothing to do. It is a very demanding practice, requiring diligence as well as alertness. This accords with what Yasutani Roshi said about Shikantaza, that it required an intense focus. If your practice goes well, you will experience the dropping off of sensations and thoughts. You need to stay with it and begin to take the whole environment as your body. Whatever enters the door of your senses becomes one totality, extending from your body to the whole environment. This is silent illumination. From this, it should be evident that it is not a matter of having nothing in your mind, but rather that you are thinking of what does not think. And this is a quote from Master Dogen, sometimes translated as think non-thinking. Your mind is fully alert, but not stuck on forms, not favoring one sensation or thought over another. As Chan Master Hongzhi Jingjue explained in his inscription on silent illumination, in silence and serenity, words are forgotten. In clarity and luminosity, all things manifest. Only this silence is the supreme speech, and this illumination the universal response. If in illumination silence is lost, then distinctions will be perceived. If in silence illumination is lost, then murkiness will lead to wasted teachings. So he's presenting here the two sides of this practice, illumination and silence, and showing how one without the other is not practice. It's not the practice of silent illumination. They have to both be present. Silence, so that we're not just caught up in discriminating consciousness, and the illumination, this shining the light of the mind back upon itself. In the Platform Sutra, the sixth ancestor said, while you are in samadhi, prajna is in samadhi, and while you are in prajna, samadhi is in prajna. Silence is samadhi, and illumination is prajna. When samadhi and prajna are not two separate things, this is silent illumination. Let's talk now of another turtle. In the sutras, there is a parable of a turtle pulling in its feet, head, and tail when in danger. This metaphor refers to reining in the six sense faculties in order to disentangle the web of false thoughts they engender and to still the mind. Sometimes we talk about closing the six sense doors. And again, this doesn't mean shutting out sensations completely, but rather not grasping at sensations in our environment, not either trying to hold on to them or trying to get rid of them. The sutra says the four elements join to form the body, and the entangling shadows of the six sense objects become the forms of the mind. The six internal sense faculties take as their object the six external sense objects, engendering the mind of false thought of the six consciousnesses. So there's this habit we have of seeking out or rejecting the objects of the senses. If you take the six sense faculties and gather them back in from the six sense objects, the false mind has no entangling objects to which it can cling. And here we can see this image of the turtle pulling in its feet, head and tail. In this regard, it's like those protrusions that extend into the external world. Retracted, brought back inside the shell. Then we're not bothered by sense impressions. This is good Chan practice, but it does not mean abolishing the function of the six sense faculties. Otherwise, you are like the turtle buried in the well. In this kind of chan, when the eyes see a beautiful form, there is no craving. And when the eyes see an ugly form, there is no loathing. The sense faculties acknowledge the corresponding sense objects, but without any false thoughts arising. This is the meaning of thinking non-thinking. The six sense faculties and the six sense objects are in contact, but discrimination, attachment, and affliction do not manifest. This is also the case when silent illumination functions in the midst of daily life. Could say that ideally we become like water, which receives impressions but doesn't hold them. Being silent in this sense means not being subject to the entangling web of delusion. Illumination means being clearly aware of the contents of the mind. It surely does not mean not using the six sense faculties, and it surely does not mean not using the mind. This is a very important point, and one that people often misunderstand. I think they have to become completely blank. Meditation teacher Alan Wallace actually tells a story of somebody he met when he was in training in India, a practitioner whose aim was, expressed aim was to stop thinking altogether. And really tragically, he was so successful in this, but he became unable to look after himself and had to be looked after by others. He's so incapacitated. Now back to the translator's preface. The term Gungan generally means public, literally means public case, as in a court case. But in the Chan context, it refers to an encounter between a Chan master and a student that often results in some insight or awakening. Beginning in the early Song Dynasty, that's 960 to 1279, Chan masters began to collect these stories into anthologies and drew from them methods for training and testing practitioners. It is said that there were as many as 1,700 Gungans collected during the Song. Some of the most famous collections are the Gateless Gate, the Blue Cliff Record, and the Book of Serenity. The term Hua Do literally means source of spoken words before they are uttered, or before the spoken word. And sometimes we refer to the Hua Do in English is the nub of the koan. So when you have the story of a monk asking Zhao Zhou, does the dog have a Buddha nature, that's the koan, and then the nub is just Joshu's reply, mu, a single word, or what is mu. And in Chinese Chan, they tend to talk more about the Hua Do and less about the Gungan, the koan. But this, again, this is very helpful to understand this meaning of the word Hua Do, source of spoken words before they are uttered, or before the spoken word. He continues, this is an indirect way to point out that which is beyond language and concepts. The source is variously referred to in Buddhism as Buddha nature, self nature, no self, no mind, and intrinsic wisdom. All are alternative names for the nature of emptiness in the Mahayana teachings. But these are only semantic explanations of the Gungan and the Hua Do. In actual practice, one does not engage in thinking or reflecting on any of these labels or ideas. In practice, a Gungan is not some interesting story to be figured out through reasoning, but is internalized as a fundamental and existential dilemma. Likewise, a Hua To is used as a critical phrase to generate an intense questioning of who we are before the onset of words and language, and of meaning, of the meaning of ultimate truth. So we can understand mu, or what, or who, as words that are used to take us beyond words. A word used to take us, lead us to the source of words. He continues, this is a famous gongan in the Gateless Gate collection. One day, a monk asked Master Zhao Zhou, does a dog have a Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhou replied, no. And in Chinese, that's wu, and in Japanese, mu. Clearly, Buddhist scriptures teach that all of us, including other sentient beings, such as dogs, have Buddha nature, the potential to become a Buddha. So why did Zhao Zhou answer no? Using this case as a gongan means internalizing it by reflecting on and questioning single-mindedly the entire story. Using the same case as a hua dou, or critical phrase, on the other hand, means just concentrating on the question, what is wu, and relating it to one's own dilemma. This is, again, a very important aspect of koan work. Not just to repeat the koan in a kind of mindless way, but connect it to everything that brings us to the mat, our own dilemmas, whatever they might be, our conflicting emotions, the battles we fight inside, all the different kinds of conflicts that we get caught up in, dualities. And these are many. The list is long, but just to give some examples. It could be the conflict between intimacy and independence. It might be that we get a certain way into a relationship and then we pull back. And this may happen over and over again. Or we might be conflicted about being in training versus family life. This was one for me, struggling about wanting to be in residential training, but being drawn also to having a family. Another one is trying to figure out material security, maybe versus freedom from duties, responsibilities. Or another one that some people struggle with is activism versus inner work, contemplative life. Which way should I go? Where should I commit? So to connect our own struggles, whatever they might be, to the koan that we're working on, so that it comes to life. And when questions arise, to be able to pour those questions into the koan. Because we can have many, many kinds of questions and doubts and concerns, but when we have a koan, then we can kind of focus all those questions into something powerful. difference between a regular incandescent light bulb with the light going off in all directions and a laser beam which can cut through hard materials because the light is gathered. It continues, Chan Master Da Hui Zonggao, a great advocate of the Hua Dao method, said that rather than meditating on the entire Gong'an, which may lead to discursive thinking, Chan adepts should just meditate on the critical phrase or fragment of the Gong'an. For this reason, Chinese practitioners typically use the Hua Dao instead of the Gong'an or Koan method favored by Japanese Rinzai adepts. I guess we don't see these two as separate methods, but rather just related aspects of one method. The story is there, we're familiar of it certainly, but then we boil down the koan to this single word or single phrase. Despite the differences between the Gong'an and the Hua Dao, the most important thing is to make these meaningless stories come to life in practice. Hence, Chan and Zen masters often speak of turning dead words into live words. To do this, you have to generate what is known as the doubt sensation. In other words, just becoming one with the method is insufficient. You must go beyond that and generate a great ball of doubt, reaching the state of oneness, and then break through this doubt to the state of no mind or no self. Becoming one with the method is insufficient, becoming one with the koan, but it's a good start to become one with the koan. Sometimes we won't find that we generate a lot of questioning, and in that case, then just to do what we can to keep it alive in our minds. But if we don't make that connection between our own suffering, our own dilemmas, then it'll be hard to sustain the koan. It's why it's helpful to remind ourselves of why we practice and generate vows out of that aspiration that we have. The doubt is a process of questioning, but you are not allowed to use any thinking or intellectual reasoning whatsoever. The point is not to answer the question, but simply to reflect on the Hua Dao or Gong'an again and again until you become completely absorbed in the sense of questioning and wonderment. This questioning and wonderment means that our mind is receptive, it's open. That's our job, just to open. We can't make some insight happen, but we just prepare the ground as best we can. The sense of not knowing can come alive only by making the question your own. Hence, why does a dog have no Buddha nature? Is really, why don't I have Buddha nature? Or what is my Buddha nature? We can imagine the monk in this story, why he asked this particular question. He may have been feeling pretty lacking, or perhaps even full of defilements. Dogs were looked down on in Chinese culture, seen as being unclean, because they would be observed eating their excrement or the excrement of other dogs, and this made them objects of disgust even. So this monk is asking this question: does even a dog have the Buddha nature? Does even the most hopeless case have the Buddha nature? So the question was personal. Now, Joshi's reply here, he would have seen where this monk was coming from. But he didn't say, "Oh, there, of course you've got the Buddha nature, you poor monk." He said, "Mu, not." Didn't give this guy anything to hold on to. Actually, there's a story of his saying the opposite on another occasion. Somebody asked him, "Does even the dog have the Buddha nature?" And he replied, "Ooh, has." So what's this all about? What's he saying? Where's he coming from? The more earnest this questioning, the stronger this doubt sensation will be. This is the most crucial point in this method. Hence the Chan saying, "Great doubt, great enlightenment. Small doubt, small enlightenment. No doubt, no enlightenment." This applies, though, to this method in particular, the method of working on a koan. There's said to be three essential ingredients to Zen practice: great doubt, great faith, and great determination. And in the koan method, it's the great doubt that is to the fore. This is where the emphasis is. But there needs to be faith and determination there as well. Faith that one can resolve our doubt, the doubt, and determination to do so, to keep going. In Shikantaza, on the other hand, you could say that these three are all present, but the emphasis is on faith. This is the most, needs to be the strongest of the three. It's having faith that just sitting in full awareness is already an embodiment, an expression of our enlightened nature. And that if we attend to our sitting with this bare awareness, that it will blossom into realization. It will ripen. But of course, the other two are present. The questions about birth and death, which we can call doubt, and the determination to awaken. We could even go so far as to say that in breath practice, it's the third element that is the one that is predominant. The determination. The determination to experience the breath fully, to come back to it, to return to it again and again and again. The determination to train our minds to stay on one thing, to be able to go deeply into the breath. Preface continues. Sometimes a practitioner gives rise to doubt spontaneously without using the Huadao method. For example, Master Dongshan, one of the co-founders of the Cao Dong, it's the Soto lineage, had a natural doubt induced by his master when he bade farewell to him. Dongshan asked his master, "After you have passed away, how can I answer those who want me to describe you?" It's really talking about the essential truth of his master. "Just this," the master retorted. Dongshan was dumbfounded and became silent. His master said, "You must be very careful and take care of this." Puzzled by this whole incident, Dongshan left his master in that state of wonderment, traveling alone in the mountains. One day he saw his own reflection in a river, and suddenly his doubt was shattered. If Dongshan had not been deeply absorbed by doubt about his master's words, he might not have realized enlightenment. He wouldn't have been open to the teaching of that reflection in the river. A similar case is the story of Japanese Zen master Dogen, who in his youth could not understand why Buddhism teaches the intrinsic enlightened nature of all sentient beings, and yet Buddhas and Bodhisattvas still need to arouse the desire for enlightenment. Another way of putting this would be say, if we're all enlightened, why is it so hard to awakening, to awaken? Why does it take such effort? This question perplexed Dogen greatly for years and drove him from his seclusion on Mount Ye across the sea to China. Dogen's doubt became the fundamental question of his own being. Years later, practicing under the Chinese master Ru Jing, Dogen heard the master scold another monk who was dozing off in the meditation hall. "In Zen, body and mind are cast off. Why are you sleeping?" When Dogen heard these words, his original doubt was shattered and he experienced enlightenment. And all through Dogen's teachings, when he came back to Japan, he emphasized this effort without grasping. He said, "Realization is effort without desire." From these stories, we can see that Chan Dao is not something contrived, but is something that drives us forward in practice. It must be connected to our own lives. In Chan, this is called the fundamental question, which is very similar to what modern people refer to as the sense of questioning but not knowing who we are, as in the sense of, what am I doing here? What is my purpose in life? What is the meaning of being alive here now? Ultimately, it does not matter what method we use or what kind of Buddhism we practice. The fundamental question must be there. The fundamental question must be there. Another way of putting this is that there must be some recognition of the first noble truth. Some recognition that we're caught up in this nightmare of self versus other. We're caught in our limited view of things. We see only really one side of the story, the side of birth and death and gain and loss and success and failure. And we cling to gain and success and can be terrified of the other side, loss and failure. And not see them, these dualisms, as two sides of one coin. But to start to realize this, to see that this is how we are stuck, and just getting some sense that we want to free ourselves from the pain of all of this, its narrowness, its constriction. And perhaps also some recognition that we're all in the same boat. That life is difficult. It's hard being a human being a lot of the time. That we're all, as Roshi Kaplow used to say, alone and afraid in a world I never made. He's a Buddhist scholar from the early part of the 20th century, Edward Conza, who wrote about this fear that we experience. According to the views elaborated by Schiller, Freud, Heidegger, and Jaspers, these are philosophers and psychologists, there is in the core of our being a basic anxiety, a little empty hole from which all other forms of anxiety and unease draw their strength. In its pure form, this anxiety is experienced only by people with an introspective and philosophical turn of mind, and even then only really. If one has never felt it oneself, no amount of explanation will convince. If one has felt it, one will never forget, however much one may try. It may come upon you when you have been asleep, withdrawn from the world. You wake up in the middle of the night and feel a kind of astonishment at being there, which then gives way to a fear and horror at the mere fact of being there. It is then that you catch yourself by yourself, just for a moment, against the background of a kind of nothingness all around you, and with a gnawing sense of your powerlessness, your utter helplessness in the face of this astonishing fact that you are there at all. Usually we avoid this experience as much as we possibly can, because it is so shattering and painful. usually, I am very careful not to have myself by myself, but the I plus all sorts of other experiences. People who are busy all the time, who must always think of something, who must always be doing something, are incessantly running away from this experience of the basic or original anxiety. What we usually do is to lean and to rely on something else that this, other than this empty center of ourselves. The Buddhist contention is that we will never be at ease before we have overcome this basic anxiety, and that we can do that only by relying on nothing at all. And of course, since this was written, we've got more and more devices to keep us busy, to keep our mind full of thoughts, so that we don't have to face up to this basic anxiety. Well, our time is up. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow